Welcome to session number, what, two? Kind of reminded of the line out of, what is it, Indiana Jones, the guy saying, "You have chosen unwisely." without ado, I suppose there we go. Usual slide bits first. My name is Luke. I work for Redify. I spend a surprising amount of my spare time and even just a little bit of work time doing game-related things. What I'm actually going to be talking about this morning is gamification, which has surprisingly little to do with games, but I'll get onto that in a moment. Okay, so I don't actually have any great love of PowerPoint myself, and I've been... Think about it, maybe kind of. Okay, deck had a minor. Nope, not going to happen. So we'll just go that size. my love of PowerPoint isn't very strong, and I've been spending a lot of time recently playing with the delights of Deus Ex and getting back into Fallout 3 and a few of those sort of games. So I've got a bit of the bad hologram effect. So I'm going to do the entire presentation in my 5-minute rendition of a bad hologram effect, which isn't quite as effective on a projector as I'd hoped. But it doesn't add anything to the presentation, so it's all good. It's just me rambling for the most part. Okay, so getting on to gamification. So gamification has a few different definitions depending on who you talk to. If you talk to, designers, they're likely to start throwing punches at you and start talking about people adding tacky game-related things onto applications and for no particularly good reason outside of it just seemed to be the cool thing to do at the particular time. So somebody develops yet another Excel clone and they think, you know what would really sell this product would be, say, a little, I don't know, Doom extension onto the side of it. Gamification also has another definition, which is the one which is a little closer to my heart, which is where you take some of the lessons learnt out of the gaming industry and apply them to design. So really it's not a case of taking the gaming hammer and bashing it on this nail of your application until it just admits defeat and falls over and dies. What it is it's basically applying good design. So, evil. If you're a designer in the room, and I'm going to guess there isn't because they would have thrown things at me, what I'm going to be talking about is not the evil side of gamification, it's the good side of gamification. I will state that if more application development happened with a designer in the room, then maybe the whole gamification topic would have never actually got started. Because really what I'm talking about is essentially exactly the same elements that go into good design, be it applications or otherwise. Okay, so anyway, topic at hand. What is that? That's a palette. Okay, talking about a palette of options. Right. What can I say? It was like 2 a.m. It seemed like a really good idea at the time. It's a conference. Okay. So, because it's a rather large topic, I'm just going to concentrate on one or two particular elements of where gamification can offer some insight. And we'll kind of explore that a little bit, and then I'll do the damn silly move of opening myself up for questions and receiving insults and abuse and things like that. Okay, so the topic that I'm going to cover is how to train your users. Yes, that's a 2 a.m. pun, and it's a little train, kind of, maybe. So training your users. What happens when a brand new user comes up and sits down in front of your application for the very first time? I spend a significant proportion of my time talking to enterprise commercial types, and probably about half my time is the development of internal applications for employees. The thing that kind of amuses me about particularly internal applications is there's a lot of effort made when you're an employee of a large organization. When you walk in the front door, a company will have spent probably a considerable amount of money making sure that the lighting is survivable, the chairs are moderately comfortable, the desks support a computer without causing you serious injury, and all of these things. And they'll sit you down in front of a machine, and then they'll say, right, all that we need you to get you to do, Bob, is to use this application. It was written in the 1960s by someone who's no longer employed. We think he hated us secretly. It's a bad mix of Excel and toolbar next gen, at least from the 80s perspective. new employee, Bob, goes, well, the job didn't sound that hard when I applied for it, but it seems that things have taken a turn for the worst. Boss dumps a gigantic tome of books in front of the employee and says, cool, you've got maybe a day, maybe 2 days. Tell you what, it's 3 o'clock. Let's call it 2 hours. We'll expect you to be up and productive anytime soon. And employee freaks out. If we're talking about learning curves, the kind of typical learning curve for a grey box, yes, a grey box application is something approximating a cliff where travelling along nicely right up until the point that they actually sit in front of the app, and then it's horrific torture for who knows how long, and then they find their little narrow path where they can actually achieve what they need to do, and if they stick to that little narrow path, then they don't experience too much pain. They never, ever veer off that path. Heaven help them if they ever veer off that path. It's learned by rote through fear and intimidation. Then we have another type of application which is becoming more popular, particularly over the last 3 years, which is the Web 2.0 application. It's the sort of application where usually it's a web page and they've gone, well, we recognize that a grey box app is too hard to deal with and we don't want to really lumber you down with a whole load of manuals, so we're going to give you this lovely little app which does, you know, the 5 things that we think need to do, and it's got probably 5 big buttons and you hit one of those buttons and off you go. Well, that's kind of okay, but it's surprisingly close to the grey box example, because as soon as you step off this little narrowly defined path, suddenly you're nowhere, really. You've effectively been constrained into whatever horrible half-baked web experience someone, once again, underpaid, done quick, in the case of internal apps, has dreamt up for you. So the learning curve is kind of just a little bump, but it's not really a kind of fulfilling experience. You've basically created a web, factory work in a cannery. So there's presumably some better alternatives to this. And the whole point of this talk is having a look at how the gaming industry tackles the issue of training users and getting users up to speed with, you know, whatever you want to teach them, and that whole malarkey. So, let's take an example. So, I'm at a Microsoft conference, so I won't mention competitors, but, what was it? early 90s, a tradesman of Mediterranean descent, became quite popular in the gaming world, had a particular dislike of turtles and boxes filled with money hanging in the air for no particularly obvious reason. If we take said game as an example, the game starts and you see your little guy at the in the middle of the screen, and that's it. There's no long instruction manual. There's no, you know, tome this thick saying, okay, well, first you need to do this and this and this. Interestingly enough, there's no, you know, demo video or anything like that. It really is just a guy standing in the middle of, you know, this open vista, kind of looking kind of bored. So you grab your trusty game controller and you start fiddling around with it. And you notice that if you touch the left and right joystick, the little man moves. And you go, cool. And so you push him left and the little guy walks. And eventually you come up against a hole and you walk straight into the hole and you die. And you go, oh, that wasn't quite so fun. But anyway, okay, game restarts. You go, cool, I'm back. Walk. Right, this hole, walking into the hole thing, not really an effective strategy. Might try some of these other buttons. So you hit one of the other buttons, and you discover that he jumps up and down. So you go, walk, jump. You probably fail the first time, but skipping forward to the next occasion, you go, walk, jump over the hole, and continue. And then the level ends. And you get a, woohoo, congratulations. And the interesting thing here is that, believe it or not, just like, you know, giving someone a tome or a little video or something, the users have picked up not one, but two skills. They've discovered, or two bits of knowledge. They've discovered how to walk and how to jump. So the next level starts up, and once again, you find yourself in a little open vista, and you walk, and you come across little holes, and you jump, and you go, oh, fantastic, I'm making beautiful progress. And then you come up against a little turtle, and you die. Okay, fast forward to the next life. You go, okay, that whole walking into turtles thing didn't really do it for me. Let's try this jump thing again. You jump over the first turtle, woohoo! And courtesy of, well, if you're anything like me and rather average at games, ironically enough for a talk like this, you find that you accidentally jump onto a turtle and you basically render him, well, not dead, passed out, concussed, some sort of animal cruelty. So you've learned how to walk, how to jump, how to concuss turtles for no particular obvious reason, and on you go. And this basically progresses for the entire game. So if we think about the learning curve, what's actually happening is instead of the learning curve being this horrible cliff or this little kind of molehill, what it is actually this stepped learning curve where you just have these little skills which you pick up along the way. And the really interesting thing about human psychology is that we seem to be pretty much hardwired for learning. And even better is that we're hardwired for learning in a way that we get a positive reaction from our own bodies when we learn. When you learn something new, when you discover that exciting moment that you can concuss turtles, your brain basically gives you a little bit of an endorphin rush. So what that learning curve actually looks like is it's a stepped learning curve, but there's a little bit of love at each step. So it's this amazingly addictive, Pavlovian cycle of, okay, experiment, have a little bit of failure, learn something new, woohoo, and up we go. Said controller. Okay. So, where am I going with this? all of it. Right. So the other thing to note about this this learning experience with our tradesmen is that these skills aren't just skills in isolation. They're actually skills that tend to build upon each other. So, for example, the jumping thing. Okay, so we learn how to jump, but then we found out that we could learn how to jump and tie it into landing on top of turtles. So, and, you know, that progresses, well, the plumber example isn't quite so good for that, but later games, it's a very common strategy where you see basically a build-up of these little individual units of skill into more and more complex tasks. Love heart. Okay, so we have little units of skill, we're building them up, and the user is learning as they go along, they're loving us for it each and every time, and once again, just harping on the fact, we didn't actually tell them how to do the task. We didn't give them a book, we didn't sit them down and say, look, you've got to go right, you've got to go left, you've got to jump here, and so forth. They had that little bit of discovery, that little bit of safe play, and they, you know, experimented and won. Right. I'll get onto that in a minute. Right. So that's learning in a positive way. Then there's learning in a negative way. So one of the significant online mail providers found that its users were struggling with, you know, basically discovering how to send mail. Their user base, in this case, is generally brand new internet users, possibly the first time they've used the web, and so they really needed to find a way to get these people up and going with mail pretty quickly. So the approach that they took was kind of the wizard approach. So the user would get presented with, you know, a brand new inbox, and this little wizard, aka kind of a Clippy style thing, would pop up and say, I've noticed you look like the sort of person who might want to send a mail or something like that. And it dutifully basically takes you through these screens. So the first screen says, okay, so in order to send an email, first of all, we need to click this button, and you hit next. And then it says, then you need to type in a subject, and the user hits next. And then you need to do this and this and this, and the user keeps on hitting next, next, next. And that's really good in theory, but then you step back from it and you ask yourself, what did the user actually learn out of that experience? And the important thing to note about all users, including myself, is that users never read anything, like ever. Just never happens. I don't know if anyone else has noticed that in between Internet Explorer 6 and later versions, the little dialogue box that tells you about changing between a non-secure and secure site content actually flipped. It started off being, did you want to display secure content? And I think in the later versions it became, did you want to hide unsecure content or something like that? And even to this day, I still just completely miss that text and hit whatever I was hitting originally, go yes, and I find myself with like half a website. And look, I can't claim any credit for my own intelligence level, but at least a few people have hired me at some point in my life, and if I'm displaying enough intelligence to be hired by someone at some point, presumably I'm at least, you know, matching other people who have used that very same dialogue box. getting back to the mail example. So these users aren't reading any of the dialogue that's being presented in these little wizard windows. They might read the first one, and they might kind of skim through the second one, and then they kind of get bored, and they go, yeah, okay, and they hit next. And if they're really dedicated, first-time users, they'll be really enthusiastic about hitting next. Next! Brand new adventure! Can't be bothered reading that. Next! Brand new adventure! next. So they come out of it learning how to hit the next button, which is not quite the same thing as sending a mail. So wizards kind of break down as well, which is, once again, tying back to games, why if you have a look through all of the really popular games, you don't see these kind of wizard things popping up. You usually don't see a long-winded narrative explaining where you are in the world, where you want to be, and stuff like that. Or if you do, it's got some amazing animatic or video along with it, which if you can find a way to do that for your average grey box application, all the more power to you. You know, presenting Excel version 3! And so forth. really, really good games. Basically don't have any of those sort of things. So we've got the little learning steps. We've got the people never read anything. And then we've got the next thing which tends to pop up in games, and particularly these days with casual gaming, social gaming, all of those type of things. And that's the concept of achievements and badges. So I'm going to commit a very, very dangerous act right at the moment. In recognition that this is being recorded, possibly, I'm going to say something which is going to get me in trouble, which is referring to my better half. So, my wife plays a lot of Facebook. A lot of Facebook. As someone who doesn't consider themselves a casual gamer, I look at the games that she plays and I go, why? Why would you do that? Because to someone who considers themselves at least a bad gamer, I look at a lot of the Facebook games and it just seems to be, you know, take World of Warcraft. It seems to be World of Warcraft with all the fun stuff removed and just the grind. And I credit my wife with being smarter than I am. And yeah, I'm just missing the kind of connection here, obviously. But the reality is, my wife is actually enjoying yet another bit of wonderful human biology when it comes to things like learning and so forth, which is earning things, getting a little pat on the back, a little bit of recognition. So all of the popular games like, you know, Farmville and Cafe and all the rest of them, they're basically built on the idea of achievements. They're actually built on another idea as well, but I'll cater to that in a minute. So if you, create, well, in any of these games, if you go and create something for the first time, there's a very good chance that you'll receive an achievement. In fact, any of the console games, once again, tend to harp on the idea with achievements. If you play Xbox 360 or any of the other consoles, what you'll find is all of these games have a whole series of achievements. And so basically anything that you do for the first time tends to result in an achievement, which acts as a really good, not surprisingly, reinforcement to going out and actively discovering what's in the game. So if you wander along and you pick something up for the first time, you may receive an achievement. If it's a violent game, if you kill someone in a spectacular fashion, not only do you get the visceral joy of watching body parts fly apart, you also get a little achievement thanking you for your extremely violent efforts. And in the case of, you know, Farmville and the like, it's, you know, the achievement isn't kind of spectacular in itself, but people really, really, you know, get addicted to the idea of these achievements. When was it? Last year I seemed to spend a lot of time talking to financial and banking institutions about these sort of topics. And it may surprise you to learn that quite a few notable financial institutions are actively pursuing, you know, things that people would normally associate with, you know, Facebook and so forth. So, achievements being a classic one. Achievements, if you want to be quite dry about it, represent a way to encourage users to explore your application. So if you want to have users step off that little path that they've found on day one and actually use the rest of your application, achievements can be those little tidbits, those little breadcrumbs to, you know, tempt them away. There's an add-on to Microsoft Office, which you may have seen, called Office Hero. Hands up, anyone who's seen Office Hero? Well, a few. Okay, so for those of you who haven't, I strongly recommend downloading it. And it's not so much a case of you playing around with it, although that's good. It's something to give those people, particularly those family members who are always bugging you about Office and how to use Word and all of those other type of things, because if there's one thing that, you know, an IT pro or a developer knows immediately, it's how to use Word. So what Office Hero does is it adds achievements to Office. So if you discover where the print button is, you get an achievement. If you change the font size of something, you get an achievement. And if you install Office Hero in an office, what you start to see is something kind of a little closer to what you might associate with a LAN party. So you have, you know, Mary on one side of the aisle going, "Ooh, I just got, you know, an achievement for this," and kind of giving a kind of cowboy greasy eyeball to Jane across the aisle, and, you know, and Jane goes, "Well, I just got a bigger achievement through, I don't know, printing double-sided." Anyway, so Office Hero, just through the simple act of adding achievements, suddenly radically transforms how people use Office. Suddenly they're really eager to step out of their little comfort zone and try new things. They become, you know, educated on the product, require less support, particularly from family members, and the world is a better place. And yeah, once again, diametrically opposed to what a lot of applications tend to try and foist upon you, you know, great big manuals, training videos, all the rest of it. It's yeah, just tapping into that natural enthusiasm to learn, but not learn great big scary things all at once, just in little bite-sized pieces. The other, the kind of partner to this is the idea of a score. I really, really must have been in a happy place when I thought of that association. So, musical note score. Score. I think it was Asteroids? Someone will probably correct me. So, Asteroids in 1970-something introduced, believe it or not, the idea of a score and a high score table. It's kind of like achievements in some ways, the idea of a score. So you can, compete with friends and so forth. But a score has another kind of slightly more, dare I say, insidious quality to it. How many people here are members of, say, LinkedIn, the LinkedIn website? How many of you may have noticed they've flicked it all around, but somewhere on the screen there's this little progress bar to tell you how far in relieving yourself of any anonymity you might be. So I think I'm a bad, bad LinkedIn citizen because I hover at about the 20%, which I think they get a pretty photo of me and a short bio, but they might even know where I went to high school, but that's kind of about where it ends. If I want to provide, I don't know, right down to my blood type, presumably that little bar grows. the main reason why they have that little bar graph, the little progress bar, sorry, is not because it's pretty, although that does help. The main reason they do it is human beings have an amazingly strong need to complete the set. Now, how well you can repress that need really depends on how OCD-ish you are. For a lot of people, they can kind of, it's kind of more of a subconscious thing, you know, they see the kind of 20% on the little progress bar, and they go, yeah, I might click that, you know, because I've got 5 minutes to spare because I'm at work, and off I go. For other people, that need to complete the set is a lot stronger. And once again, it's one of those things that game developers have known for quite some time. So you'll get almost every second game on the market has little collectibles that you pick up, you know, five of these and collect all the stars and all the rest of it. That need to complete the set is such a compelling thing that, well, not only has it become a popular idea, but it, it shows up everywhere now. So what have we got? Skills, badges, achievements, points. I think that's about my my repertoire of examples. Yes, I think so. Cool. Okay. So it's at this point where I take the risky move of answering some questions. And before I answer any questions, I'll answer a question of my own, which is one of the kind of most common ones that I get, which is, okay, so this sounds all really, really good, but back in the real world, where I've got a boss with a budget of about that much to spare on particularly internal apps, you know, how often does these sort of gamification things actually show up in business? And my answer to that is more than you might think. I will admit, if you're in a company developing a product, either internally or externally, where it's a just make it work, get it out there as quickly as possible, then obviously you're up for a bigger fight than most. If you're working on a product that has a designer somewhere in the process, possibly way too early in the process, and they're never seen from again, then the conversation becomes a little easier. It's another engagement of mine, probably about 2 years ago now. We, as part of a bigger workload, had to develop this little internal tool to basically match up things from one depot with another depot. So, you know, the kind of inventory matching stock take type thing. The company in question really, really liked Excel. I should have thought of it before. I wish I had right now a picture of the guy who created VisiCalc, because this particular company could have had this guy framed up on the wall going, oh, we love cells. And they were basically, you know, they had everyone in the office, pretty much no matter what they did, it was in Excel. So if it was writing up, you know, a sales proposal, that happened in Excel. If it was calculating something, surprise, surprise, it was in Excel. And in this case, this matching kind of scheme, that was also going to be, well, not in Excel, but they basically wanted a grid where, you know, you've got things on the left and presumably on each cell on the right you have this drop down from hell. So item A, drop down, boom, A, B, 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 C, C, and off we go. And the idea was that staff members, that's what they do all day. And if that isn't the most exciting thing you've ever heard of, well, so as an act of compassion against for our fellow man, we thought, let's explore just going one step further than Excel outside of this magical world of cells and see if we can, you know, make life at least a little more, well, not particularly entertaining, but at least not mind-numbingly drop-down list picking factory worker goodness. So what the client basically turned into was, what's the best description for it? It actually kind of bore a close similarity to the kind of reality. So on the left-hand side, you basically had a box or a carton or something that you needed to find a match for. And on the right-hand side, you had basically a bucket or a set of buckets. And so in order to say that this carton or this box from one depot was the equivalent of some other classification from another depot, what you'd do is you'd flick this box across the screen and it would land in one of the buckets. Not, you know, a contender for Fallout 3 anytime soon, and at the heart of it, not particularly different in terms of operational complexity than the XL model. And the actual act, you know, yes, in one of the early versions I did actually embed a physics model because that's just the kind of geeky person I am. But it's not actually the kind of game, the flicking from one side of the screen to the other side of the screen that made it different. It's the fact that it, for one, it was just good design in as much as that it simplified the interface. You know, people just found a box, found an item and flicked it across, and there was no complex Excel thing. There was no drawing little lines, although drawing little lines has its own appeal. It was, just the super simple act and kind of fun. You could do it with your keyboard, you could do it with your mouse, and there was enough on-screen animation and maybe a bit of a sound effect to make it viscerally enjoyable as a regular activity. Where was I going with all of that? Okay, so this was not done in a culture which was, pro anything but Excel. So the conversation that we had with the business was not one of, hey, gamification is really cool. How would you like to pay for some of it? It was along the lines of actually selling the boring kind of analytical process benefits of it, i.e. people can track down buckets a lot faster and track down these little carton things a lot faster than the Excel equivalent. So there have been other discussions and other engagements that I've had where it actually has been a whole lot more enthusiastic. And actually the one that took me by surprise was a financial institution where we were asked to come up with a whole load of ideas around this particular financial institution's new mobile offering. And we were hearing just whispers on the side, you know, what they really want is what's on their website, which is a whole load of home loan calculators or something like that. And I thought to myself, home loan calculators, really? Does anyone actually go to home loan calculators and go, ooh, tell me of your mortgage goodness? So I basically went back and basically sat down one night and wrote out about, I think, a dozen gaming ideas, which I thought would be kind of cool to experiment with in the world of banking. Didn't put in any of the obvious ones, like, once again, the kind of Doom client shooting down various things, because there's really no kind of good associations that can come with that. Also, completely bypassed that whole kind of gambling thing, you know, the poker machine thing, because can't see the bank being too enthusiastic about that. Incorporating things like badges, achievements, points, and, you know, those sort of things, and came up with about a dozen of them. And much to, my surprise, I was expecting them to, you know, slap me down and say, you idiot, what are you doing? This is a bank. But no, they said, oh, okay, that sounds cool. And just quietly, we've been thinking about doing kind of a similar thing anyway, so it's nice to have someone else, you know, put their hand up first and step out into the light and say that it's possibly a good idea. Off we went on this mobile project, incorporating those and other ideas. And now I'm stuck in the dilemma of, I know out there, at least away, behind closed doors, there's a banking product that I really actually want to use. That I, and not just for the bells and whistles, the actual mechanic of managing accounts, my finances and all the rest of it, is actually fun and enjoyable. So, yes. Anyway, back to the story at hand. Yes, the conversation, it's not always easy, but it's not as difficult as what some may perceive. So, any questions in the middle of... Yes? Yep. Okay. So, one of the other examples is a auction house, one of the online auction houses. Once again, in the mobile space, for this particular example, but it holds true for non-mobile as well. Basically, this auction house was interested, as all businesses are, in expanding their market, you know, getting new users. Their existing user base for many, many years had been your kind of OCD trading types, you know, those sort of people who basically do on a computer what they would do in real life, which is find an auction house, scurry down the back, spend hours searching out and ferreting out all these little bits and pieces, possibly hide it away so that no one else can find that particular item, and then when it comes up for auction, you know, they bid some extremely low price and walk away a happy person. That's a fantastic audience to have, and this particular auction house had made a lot of money from that particular crowd, but they recognise that there's a lot of other people in the world. And one of the scenarios that we talked about was, say, a bunch of guys sitting either at home or at the pub or whatever, and one of them makes one of those kind of usual outlandish statements, you know, I picked up a really good bottle of red, you know, for an extremely low price. And one of the other friends, you know, goes, well, I think I have a little more purchasing prowess. You know, let's put this to the test. And within literally kind of two or three clicks, this auction house allows them to basically have either a kind of gentleman's bet where they just monitor particular auctions, or whether they actually, you know, go, okay, we all want to buy some wine, let's each go and, you know, do our respective bids and so forth, and at the end of the week we'll see who came out the better man. And all of this is in the, you know, two or three thumb clicks. In the case of a mobile, you know, you can do all sorts of funky tricks to make it really easy for people to create groups and create competitions and so forth. So there's that element. In the very same, for the very same customer, getting back to monitoring auctions, just little things, actually. If instead of just offering essentially a tally of where you stand for the various auctions that you're in, they offered a selection of different ways to represent where you were at your auction. And it's going to sound really cheesy, but it's surprisingly effective. One of the views was a radar screen, which showed your, like, in the centre was the prize, and around were the various bidders, distance representing how, you know, far they were. Now, that would have been effective by itself. The little added extra was the screen updated only after you had opened it. So, for example, if you hadn't opened the screen for, I don't know, a week, you would see it start off with where you were a week ago, and then it would animate to where you are now. And just that little bit of animation adds an amazing amount of impetus and an amazing amount of adrenaline to the process. And people, yeah, get hooked on that sort of thing. Some of the other screens were borrowing from people who certainly know their job well, the kind of Kino style screen where you've got some cheesy little animatic and, you know, like on a golf course or whatever, and at the end of the day it's not actually displaying anything new, but it's enough kind of visual interest to keep things going. So did that... Okay, so this isn't about adding 3D graphics to the process, if that's the issue. In the case of a grey box application, the reality is that you're probably not going to be able to shift it away from being a grey box application at the end of the day, no matter what you do. So what it comes down to is actually more, well, as I was mentioning at the start, more just good design than anything else, but in the case of where you're requiring people to enter their details and apply tool, you know, the same functions over and over again, then you take the approach of things like basically giving them a chance to experiment safely, which... particularly, once again, for internal systems, seems to be, you know, almost the first thing that gets culled in the budget. These are our staff. They won't make mistakes. And if they do, we feel absolutely fine in, you know, giving them the electronic equivalent of a slap up the back of the head. How dare you enter in a 28-digit number incorrectly? What are you, some sort of idiot? This will be stored on your permanent record. So there's experimentation where if people are entering in details, they can they get you know, good validation basically, and it's validation presented in a way that's not a, if your manager is behind you, you're going to receive a pay cut if he sees you doing this. It's a, okay, you've deviated slightly, but it's okay. When you do it correctly, you know, you get a great big tick, a very cheesy tick, you know, a tick straight out of clip art on the side, and life continues on well. The other thing is things like progress bars, you know, where there's you're not just in this quagmire of data entry, you're actually, you know, some part of the way through the progress, and layering on top of that points and achievements. It doesn't have to be anything sophisticated. It can be just simply, you know, yet another label up the top right hand corner of the screen, and it can just be, you know, points for basically achieving business goals or achieving what you'd hope would be personal goals. So if someone completes a form successfully with no validation errors, that's a few points. If they complete a form just full stop, maybe that's a few points. And so you can start giving positive benefits that are at a more granular level than just the, you know, people going, I did my job well today, and the next day, oh, I did my job well today. It can be at a far more granular level where you can go, you know, where somebody sits down, does the same menial task that they were doing yesterday, but this time they're getting points for it. This time they can go, you know, chat over lunch, you know, I just got 1,000 points. Or, you know, I set a new weekly record for myself of 10,000 points. Cool. And yeah, just some way to measure their progress in a positive way. Now, it should be said at this point that you need to make sure that this doesn't turn into the Big Brother evil metric from hell. You know, this will be recorded on your chart somewhere up on the wall. I used to work for a rather well-known large Japanese company, it's not true of certainly, you know, all Japanese companies, but it's certainly true of some of the larger Japanese companies of the time, where for developers, what they did was they measured your performance by the number of lines of code that you wrote, which was, you know, and interestingly enough, when it came to doing quality assurance, they basically had a formula which said, if you produce 10,000 lines of code, our experience tends to suggest that you'll have 20 bugs. The interesting spin on it, which kind of took me a little time to kind of adjust to, was it's not a case of, okay, you've only found 10 bugs, therefore you must be writing better code. It was, so where are these other 10 bugs? We can't release until you find those other 10 bugs. We know they're hiding in there somewhere. You better find those 10 bugs. In an even further strange twist, what is it? Is it that Dilbert talking about safety? The pointy haired boss saying our new target is only 5 injuries per month. We had to take a hammer to 3 of our employees to make it, but you know, we got there. The strange little kind of side effort for that is, now I'm not sure whether it was the company that I was working for or some other company, but for the briefest of time, they actually had in place a reward scheme to basically encourage testers to find bugs. And I imagine it was literally nanoseconds from them saying that to a tester just ever so quietly picking up the phone to their nearest developer and saying, have I got a deal for you? Yes, anyway, getting back to the point. The really important thing about these points is that they need to be kept in a positive light. As, you know, all of those kind of team metrics type things need to be kept in a positive light. As a really interesting side effect, if you haven't come across it before, if you start putting up graphs on a wall for a team and you never actually talk to the team about those graphs, you just put the graph up and, you know, have the axis labeled appropriately, like number of bugs versus name or whatever, that has an amazing effect on the team. Whether it's positive or negative, I suppose, comes down to what you're measuring, but it's amazing how much of this kind of ambient feedback is prevalent. Did I come close to answering the question? Close. Okay. Any other questions? 1, 2, yes.
Sound.
Sound?
Modern games tend to use a lot of sound effects.
Yep.
In a crowded, busy office, that's maybe not going to be very practical.
This is true. When was it? Last year I had the interesting experience of being on a client site next to a person who had taken the time and effort to associate every different action that was possible in Outlook with a different sound, and every different seemingly contact in Outlook with a different sound. So this guy's machine, and he had speakers hooked up, this guy's machine for the entire day would just be this collection of all of those sound effects which seemingly kind of drifted out of favour about 20 years ago. So there would be that The Simpsons quote where everyone has a catchphrase but Lisa, you name it, and it was just all day. And if you thought people tapping pens next to you was difficult, anyway, sounds. So sounds, yes, have to be tackled really, really carefully in an office environment. I don't know about anyone else, but even just the little kind of ding of, you know, an instant message or you know, any of Skype or any of those type of things tends to wear me down a little. If you're aiming this at an office environment, I would probably actually just save the sounds for your upper echelons of achievements. So the equivalent of, you know, the bell for the sales team in the office. It doesn't have to be anything over the top, just a little ding which says, congratulations, you've achieved a truly magnificent achievement. you know, the little ding somewhere in the office, which probably doesn't happen more than, say, once a week or once a month or something, and, you know, no one's going to notice it in the stream of conversation and phone calls and all the rest of it, but those who do notice it will go, oh, cool, you know, Jane, Bob, whoever has obviously done something special. So, yeah, sound limited, very, very limited. I used to, another boring story for you, I used to work in a group which produced point-of-sale software for 60% of the Australian retail market. I'll let you guess who those particular retailers are. So one of the features in this particular product, which is always there but no one actually leaves switched on, is voice. So basically the idea is you're in a supermarket and as the cashier is swiping the items, this voice is saying, you know, well, not the product, but I think it's the price or discounts or something like that. Basically, you know, talking to you in a kind of chatty manner. And that sounds really good, particularly when you're demoing it to potential customers and they're hearing this automated voice and it sounds kind of Star Trek-ish. And they go out and they convince the business that they need this voice option enabled. And, you know, if you go into Coles or Woolworths or any of those type of stores, there's about 20, 40 aisles, each with one of these point-of-sale units, each with a little speaker, each with a little voice. And, yes, it's another version of hell, where you get your first stream of customers going through, and it's this cacophony of, you know, just a multitude of echoes. $3.95, $4, $5, you know, discount on wine or whatever. I did actually hear of one of the point-of-sale things that did actually attempt to read out items, like the actual product description, ignoring the fallibilities of text-to-speech technology. Imagine, even if they got it perfect, just the horrible, horrible situations that are likely to be present in a supermarket which, amongst the boring things like bread and milk and so forth, also sells toiletries, adult products, various non-prescription medical products, all of those type of things where you're not really quite willing to share with the outside world, you know, 70 decibels what you're purchasing. Even ignoring that, just the weird association of products together. So I'm going to have to rely on you to believe me when I say that this is not my own example. But I do remember coming across an example where it was, what was the product list? It was something like, God, I'm going to get shot by this from Microsoft. It was Vaseline, cucumber, and I can't remember what the third product was, but suffice it to say, it was a bit hard in a public setting to have those list of items, and this customer just standing there going, yeah, well, that just sounded a little wrong, didn't it? Gosh, I'm glad they shared that with the world. Anyway, boring stories aside, sound in an office environment needs to be taken carefully. If you're doing a shrink-wrapped product that's going out to customers and it's particularly customers in a home setting, then it's actually a completely different ballgame. You can go nuts with sounds and they don't need to be particularly high quality. They can just be the little dings and all the rest of it, and you'll get that positive side effect with relatively little effort. The important thing to remember is to offer the option to switch it off, particularly if your product is likely to be used by children, not for the children's sake, because they're all too happy to listen to the same ding over and over again, but any parents within like a household's worth just hearing ding, 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 ding. Yes, so sound, yes.
Going over there.
Very cool. A server-side product that I used to work on. This particular product was written in the 80s, and at the prevalent thought at the time was, you know who's really smart? University students. We need to get university students in to write our server product. So it kind of had a bit of a shaky start. So anyway, one of the kind of cool things about this server product was when it detected that it was in an unstable state and, you know, needed to shut down or whatever, it would emit a series of beeps, which are kind of like a Bond-esque bomb kind of about to go off beep. So it's now it's one thing to be in a, you know, on site at in a client server room, you know, with just one or two of these servers, and, you know, maybe once every few months here. But when you're in the testing lab where you've got like 80 of these boxes, it's like this beautiful chorus of Bond-esque villainy. Where was I going with that? So ATMs, a technology stack, which I certainly won't mention the name of, at a conference, which I also can't mention the name of. I have distinct memories of when they were just starting to demo the first publicly available accessibility text-to-speech offerings, and it's actually built into the framework. And so the presenter's up there on stage and typing in his username, and it's saying it back to him, and then he types in his password, and it says it back to him. To the entire crowd. Yes. In the case of ATMs, sound is really cool for ATMs. But it does obviously, you know, that particular example is obviously pretty silly. But for anyone who hasn't noticed, ATMs don't, unlike, you know, telephone pads, give an individual sound for each number. What they tend to do is the same thing as game consoles, which is they just alternate between, say, two sounds. So it doesn't matter, you know, basically someone listening to you hitting keys, they can't tell what keys you're hitting, but you as a user get that little bit of feedback to let you know that the key's being pressed. And in some of the ATMs, that's really useful because they're based on hardware, which even NASA looks down upon from, you know, the past. So, yeah, just that little bit of feedback, very, very good. Yes? Power-ups or cheats? Nothing comes to mind. Oh, no! I've used cheats. So, this is going to sound like the banking industry is just a bunch of guys just drinking way too much. But anyway, one of the significant banking products that I worked on a while back now, it had... When you started it up, it had, you know, a splash screen, and it, you know, told you what it was, you know, loading modules or all the rest of it. That included a mode. Now, I don't know why it was called that upon reflection, but anyway, it was called hamster mode. So you would enable hamster mode, and the splash screen would appear, but instead of it just saying boring things like, you know, initializing module A and so forth, it would give you these kind of Frankenstein-type messages like, you know, attaching limb and so forth and applying electricity. And the really cool thing was the screen went dark with a little lightning effect every few seconds. So it was literally a kind of Frankenstein moment. Provided absolutely no business value and probably not a good example of gamification, but... Did amuse the troops? Yes.
Are there any frameworks you recommend we can use in business applications?
Yep. So for anyone who didn't hear the question, the question was, are there any frameworks that I can recommend for such things in business application for use in business applications? If you're doing a grey box application, my recommendation is just it's not really a technology thing. You know, if you can provide a label with points, then that's fantastic. If you actually want, you know, and you've got time, money, and all the rest of it to actually, you know, do something special, than in the case of the Microsoft technology stack. Well, I suppose it really just comes back to what, you know, the fit. So taking advantage of one of the gaming stacks that Microsoft provides would probably be the kind of most obvious fit. This is in no way related to the fact that I'm an MVP and I may just get a little pat on the back for mentioning it, but try XNA. It's new and improved and shiny. So frameworks like XNA are designed to normally do, you know, produce games on Windows Mobile, Windows Phone 7, Xbox 360 and PCs and so forth. And in the case of XNA, that's doing 2D and 3D graphics, hopefully with relatively little effort. It's not the cleanest fit that I've ever seen, but it is possible to embed XNA in a, you know, WinForms app or a WPF app. There's no kind of technology stacks that kind of jump out at me as with everything that's, you know, just comes in the box. Probably the most important thing to take away, at least in terms of most of these things, is that they really should be super easy to implement and quick and cheap. So particularly points and achievements and so forth. There's no reason why points, achievements or anything else should represent a performance burden or represent more than 100 lines of code. As long as it doesn't take down the system or have some horrible other side effect, you should hopefully be able to, you know, add a little points increment to whatever screens and get as sophisticated as you want. The really important thing is take note of examples. Now, there are two things that I should mention at this point. One is that one guy who's been talking about this sort of subject for quite a long time and used to work for Microsoft and then did again and then has now left is a guy who I'm hoping he goes by the handle of Dan C. But I have this sneaking suspicion that now that I've said that, he probably actually does go by the handle of Dank, which just doesn't sound right. He runs a truly magnificent resource called lostgarden.com, which I recommend anyone, even if you don't care about games at all, go and have a quick peek at. He has a presentation called The Princess Rescuing Application, which basically harps on the kind of similar way that I did, except possibly more succinctly. He's a really good resource. And I think he has links to anyone else that I was going to mention now that I think about it. So lostgarden.com is a good place to get started. He talks about skill trees and skills and a lot of other game design-related strategies which aren't unique to games at all. Just tapping into, you know, human psychology, a.k.a. just like, you know, good design should. So, any other questions? No? Yes? One? Yes? Mm-hmm. Yep, yep.
So would it be best to go with that line or like adjust gamification along like in respect to other factors, like, or would it be like gamification as a whole?
Okay, so attempting to surmise the question, how would I, in terms of the amount of effort involved and thought, how would I balance up gamification versus other things like accessibility and all the rest of it? In a world with design, it's just another one of those factors, and you consider it kind of pretty much on par because If you take a design-centric approach, the idea is to meet your users' needs emotionally, intellectually, not make them look like idiots at work, that sort of thing. If you're way over the other side of the scale and you're working on a project where it's the user needs to hit this button 70 times a day and we just don't care about anything else, then gamification turns into just that little added extra, basically that kind of little added bonus for a project. So when you have discussions about, when you go through those initial concepts of how do we design this app so it's usable if nothing else, if you can be thinking in the back of your mind, what would it take to take this from, just an ordinary experience to, a compelling experience, then you might find that you can kind of get halfway there, maybe not having, achievements and points and all the rest of it, but at least you're kind of on the path there. And if you do find yourself going, okay, we do actually have a little time up our sleeves, so we can add in points or whatever, then, yeah, life is good. So I don't think I answered your question, but... So I'm going to take the extremely wimpy answer and say, if I was designing an application that I wanted users to actually use and be productive with, then I would be applying a strong design ethic to it, gamification really is just a shard of that whole discussion around usability and motivation and all of those type of things. So gamification stops being this add-on thing, and it's really just part of the wider discussion about is this something that the user is inherently motivated by? Is it something that we can proactively just nudge them along to be motivated to do? Can we lead them with a carrot as opposed to swiping them with a stick and that sort of thing? Any other questions before I let you go free into the world? And that's got to be some sort of record. You have now survived with my nasal voice for like over an hour. I actually have been delivered training where I've wound up with a pregnant woman on the floor, and I thought, no, that's really not kind of that's not making me feel good as a presenter. Anyway, so any other questions before I let you go free? No, I think you're safe. If you want to find me, I'll be around, obviously. If you want to find me on the interwebs, I go by the strange collection of letters, LZCD, which could be short for Lusty Zebras Coagulate Daintily. No. You can find me anywhere. And with that, I'll let you go free. Enjoy.